Hi everyone, this is April Wallace. I'm the Associate Features Editor for the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. It's not all that often that documentaries are shown in a theater setting, and in Northwest Arkansas, we don't see too many of them with a local tie-in or two, but that's exactly what The Artist and the Astronaut does. The film by director Mee Winch, with music by composer Todd Hoban, centers on the unlikely love story of sculpture artist and civil rights activist Pat Music and her Apollo astronaut husband Jerry Carr. Pat Music's art has been on display at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, and the couple lived in the Northwest Arkansas region for 20 years. The Arkansas premiere of the award-winning film will take place 7 p.m. Friday, May 19th at the Walton Arts Center. A question and answer session with the director and the music composer will follow. I spoke with them recently over Zoom.
Good morning. It's nice to meet you, Todd.
Very nice to meet you, April. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Of course. I'm happy to talk with you. Well, let's start from the beginning with how the idea for this film came about and you know, what interested you both in this couple?
Well, in 2007, Pat Music and Jerry Carr moved from Arkansas, where they had spent 20 years, to Manchester, Vermont, which is where I live and I teach. At the time, I was teaching a course called Space and Time about space exploration. So when an astronaut came to town, everyone said, you have to meet the astronaut. And everywhere he went, they said, you have to meet Bill Mensch. From that meeting, I became very good friends with his wife, also Pat Music, who is a sculpture artist. And in 2016, on her 90th birthday, we went out to the Crystal Bridges Museum to celebrate her birthday. My wife and I are teachers, so we flew out on a Friday night and had to be back on a Sunday. And on the way back, when it was Pat's 90th birthday, on the way back, I said to my wife, somebody has to do a documentary about these people. And she said, well, you should. So that's what started in 2016. I was teaching high school, I was coaching basketball, and I just began doing interviews with them, traveling the country. And then to give you all the information, 4 years later, I had a film. And I was a lifelong fan of Todd Hoban's music. We weren't friends at that point. We had similar connections, but we weren't friends. And I reached out to him and said, you know, I love your music. Could I use a couple songs from your catalog? And he was very generous and said, of course. And I sent him the rough cut and he looked at it and realized without original score that the film was dead in the water. And so now here's someone who I was a huge fan of because of COVID, had the time now to say, I'm going to try scoring the film. And over the next 2 years, Todd wrote 83 different pieces of music and 10 original songs that appear in the film. So
that's amazing. Quite the task.
So that's, yeah.
Before we move on, so you taught high school and coached basketball. Had you ever made a film before this one?
Not at this level of, I had made films. I teach cinematography also. So I've made films, but not a feature length film that that took off like this and has a wider appeal outside of my family.
Well, what was the typical sort that you were used to producing?
5 minute. I always loved doing interviews and I would interview Vermonters similar to your Arkansas people, the people that really, you know, the farmers, the third generation veterinarians, the painters. And I would do 5 minute profiles, the people that were 100 years old that grew up in Vermont. I would do 5 minute profiles of those. I love doing interviews and then shooting B-roll around the farms and things like that. So it was a pretty standard package, except I just got to learn a lot about the people that were true Vermonters, because most of the people here come from New York eventually and New Jersey and other places.
Gotcha. I love that. My main thing here at the paper is profiles. It's
Well, I have to tell you, and I mean this, I told Todd this morning, I reached out to you personally. I had gone through and it seemed like it was something you would be interested in. So it wasn't like I just did a cold call. It was your stuff. And I looked at what you had done before also. So
well, thank you.
I did my homework.
So Todd, when you got the request, you know, what stood out for you? What made you want to be a part of it?
Bill sent me a rough cut of the film and had dropped in, some placeholders, let's call them that, you know, a little music that he thought might work there, right? And so my wife and I got to see the whole film pretty much in its infancy, but the story was there. And Bill is such an incredible storyteller. We were immediately caught up in the story of these two people who we'd never really heard of, you know, and it's like they were everywhere. They were, you know, at the beginning of the space program. He's like an incredible astronaut, an amazing man. Her art is phenomenal. She taught and lived down the road from me, you know, in Ithaca, New York. So we were both just stunned at this beautiful love story. And once I realized that it was going to be virtually impossible to finish the film without a substantial influx of money, I went to my son, who runs our company. It's a post-production facility. That's what we do. We make music and work on films and radio spots and a lot of albums. You know, we do music. And I said, gee, you know, I got this beautiful film. I want you to see it. And I think you're going to love it as much as I do. And I would like you to help me do this. We had an ace, or Bill had an ace he didn't know about. And what that ace was, my son went to Lemoyne College, which is here in Syracuse, New York, and he got an internship, a job work study at the college, working for 3 years with Bill's father, Tom. So as soon as Brett found out that his mentor, his buddy, this guy that he just loves, has a son who needs some help, he said, yeah, we're in. We're going. We are all in 100%. That was 2 years of pretty crazy amounts of studio hours and lots of work. But we got her done.
Well, very neat. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the score then, like what type of music, is it orchestral? Is it?
Yes. Oh, and yes, yes, yes to all the above and many, many more. It covers 60 years of time, maybe a little more really. And so there is music from the 50s. There's music from the 60s and the 70s. There's current music. And each setting was different. You know, it's a whole lot different writing about the, you know, a space launch to the moon and then this beautiful, sad, wonderful walk out in Arkansas and out in Oklahoma where Pat's stellar, expansive artwork is in nature. And there was a lot of nature scenes. That's the kind of artist she is. She digs stuff up from the environment and makes it work. There's Native American issues. There's women's issues. There are Black American issues. So that, you know, there's some funky stuff in there when, you know, from the 60s. And of course, if you're a musician, that's a challenge, but it's a fun challenge. It's like, holy cow. You know, I'd look at this film and Brett and I would sit there and watch it and go, oh boy, what do you hear there? And then we throw some names around some fields. I'd pick up the guitar and play a little something, sit at the piano and play something. He said, no, that's not it. Try something else. You know, we just try a bunch of things until we kind of settled on what we really love. The open of the film is actually very heroic, and there's this theme. It's a space theme. It's like a heroic space theme that comes through the entire film. You'll hear it. It ties the whole score together. Even though there are many, many parts, that theme sneaks in there and lets you know from the beginning to the very last note of the film that we're talking about this love story of two amazing folks.
When I think of music in relation to like space movies, I think big, grand, soaring, kind of expansive sounds. But it sounds like you had a lot of different styles and techniques and combinations of musicians then?
There's quite a cast of characters in the music department. And, there's a lot of orchestral stuff. As you can imagine, if you're thinking about, flying into space or landing on the moon, you sort of have to have those big horns and the brass and the strings and all that stuff that implies expansive, bigger than the world stuff. There's some really touching moments of the astronauts in space on Christmas. So you hear the holiday feel of everything. And as you could guess, also, when we are out in nature, you hear the acoustic guitar playing away. There's flutes, there's Native American instruments that you sort of hear when we're talking about, the Trail of Tears with the Native Americans. Yeah, a lot of stuff.
What was the hardest part of the film to really find what was going to suit it musically?
The answer is all of it, including because, Bill was a one-man wrecking crew. He went out and shot all this stuff by himself. This is like, it's unbelievable. I worked on films before. There's like 25 people on the set, No, Bill went there, set the cameras, set the audio, set the lights, and did the interview, all this stuff all by himself. It's unbelievable, right? So when we got when we saw the film, there was some, what we actually did, and Brett is really responsible for this, and my team, we completely peeled off all of the audio from every source and then remixed the entire film.
Yeah.
I'd have to say the mixing is kind of tough, Like I'm gonna write a little guitar music, that I feel fits, but then Brett has to tuck it in and make it make sense with all the dialogue. And the dialogue, it's unbelievable because there are so many sources on two continents and nine states and all these different setups. A lot of the folks were older folks like me, and capturing that and getting it on the film. And we realized that a lot of our viewers are going to have lived through this time period, and we want them to get every single word. So it was a big job, not going to lie.
Soft-spoken voices and stuff that you got to work with.
Exactly, and weak voices sometimes. Bill got some interviews by people literally the last time they ever spoke about the topic. Some people who had never spoken about it.
That's really special.
Oh, it is. And he got incredible footage. When people see this film, they're usually just stunned at the visuals because nobody's ever seen this footage, and stunned that they're looking at, images of these people back in 1960 and change, and then talking about themselves, mm-hmm, 60 years later. It's a look at history that most people never, ever, ever get, ever.
Well, I'd love to learn, Bill, a little of how you've managed to compile all of that from the interviews that you did yourself to the footage that we haven't seen. How did you know what you needed, and how did you managed to get it all?
Well, I had to learn on the fly because we were making the film. I had to learn about these things, but I had over 50 hours of interviews to go into this hour and a half film. And I can't even answer how I compiled it. It is similar to what Todd said. You'd watch it, you'd play some music. For me, I would edit it. There are pieces I spent months editing and never made the film. I had to look. So I would hear something and I would have to become an expert on it. And then I would try to cross-reference it with other people. So I didn't want one person's story. I treated every story like it was a phone call. So when Pat was talking about being moved because the Black students took over the student union at Cornell, and she knew the students, and the press was portraying it as if these were students that had gone wild, and she knew they were sweet kids and they had honest grievances. My next thing was, all right, who was in charge of the Willard Strait takeover? And then I'd find that person who happened to be in North Carolina and then go into an interview with him. So we'd go back and forth while he was saying we were inside doing this, Pat was outside. I did the same thing with Jerry when Jerry talked about being in mission control for some of these space missions that nobody knows about. I would then talk to the astronaut. So while the astronaut was in trouble doing something and Jerry was speaking to him, we could go back and forth like it was a phone call, mm-hmm. Which makes it much more interesting than somebody just telling you the story and you have to believe that what they're telling you is the exact version. Mm-hmm. So it's an impossible one to answer in a soundbite. It was just something that I would go over and over until it felt right. And that meant that I usually did something wrong 10 times before I got it right and felt this is what is the version I want in the film.
It sounds like you were kind of formulating as you went on. You knew what you needed to pursue next based on what you began with.
Yeah, we would finish an interview. There was one particular one where I learned about a priest named Dan Berrigan, who was one of he was on the top 10 most wanted list during the 70s because he was rallying people against the Vietnam War. Well, I didn't know anything about Dan Berrigan. And once I heard about Dan Berrigan from Pat, I then called my dad because I found out that Dan Berrigan had taught at Le Moyne. I said, is anybody there at Le Moyne that remembers Dan Berrigan? He goes, oh, Father Dan, a different Father Dan, who's 90 something years old. He's was good friends with him. I said, great, I'll be down and do the interview. Then a friend of mine was in the Nixon administration and I called him and said, do you know Dan Berrigan? And he went, that son of a bitch was such a pain in our ass. And I said, well, would you say that on film? He goes, yes, yes. So all of a sudden I'm able to bring this person who passed away a decade ago back to life through the Nixon administration, his friend, and how he impacted Pat's life as a 50s housewife who all of a sudden became aware of, as Todd said, the war, racial issues, unresolved issues with Native Americans, and taking care of the earth, all of those things. And it's a woman's story. I mean, it's a woman. It really is. You kind of, it's the artist and the astronaut. You start to watch it, and you go, this really is about a woman who was a 50s housewife who early on in the film, all of a sudden we've got shots of her with a Guatemalan dress and short hair. And she's all of a sudden using art to express her change of her life as she's understanding what's going on.
That's really neat. So tell me some of the historic events that are pieced throughout.
Well, the Trail of Tears, which they spent their later years making art about, which was really important. There is the Vietnam War. There is 1968 with the Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King being killed and all the protests that were going on the campuses. I kind of put that together. There is the major missions of Apollo, I don't know if you need the list, but Apollo 8, the first time we went around the moon, of course, Apollo 11, walking on the moon, but Apollo 12, which is a forgotten mission, which had a lot of excitement, and Jerry was a part of that. And then Jerry commanded the longest mission that Apollo had. And at that time, nobody was even paying attention. And it was a real important one because everything we're doing now is longer missions in space. And this was the this was the longest. He spent the most time in space for many years. He held the record. And then we go back to Christa McAuliffe and Challenger. We talk about that, and you get to see footage of Christa training that no one has ever seen, and beautiful footage. And she was always a teacher, and she was always laughing and smiling. And she was to have that precious footage. And to see her really alive and not just sitting for an interview, just see her interacting is critical. And then it goes on to, we actually, when you see their art, we have to backtrack and explain the things that the art deals with. So we would go back to the Trail of Tears. We'd go back to issues of pollution that Jerry became aware of when he was in space, because he could look down and see what was happening to the Earth.
Oh, wow.
So basically all the same stuff we're dealing with right now.
That's such a unique insight, that perspective, seeing the pollution from outside of the Earth. Wow.
Well, that was, Jerry went from a cold warrior who flew jets over the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's one of the first events. Cuban Missile Crisis is a big thing. He flew jets in the early 60s. And was a test pilot. When he got up in space, he changed from a cold warrior to someone who felt that he needs to let people know that we have to take care of this planet that we all live on, that we all share, that we have to take care of. That was a huge change for him. For Pat, Pat went from a 50s housewife to an activist in a way. And, she had an incredible change. So the two of them, to see how these events affected them, is what the film does until they get together in the 70s and they make art reflecting back on all the events that they went through. And as Todd said so well, they're like Forrest Gump. They're showing up at major events and in the beginning of the film at different places on Earth. And sometimes Pat's on the ground and Jerry's in space and they hadn't met yet.
That's really cool. Well, tell me so far the awards that you've won, to switch gears a little bit, and where all you've screened. I know your release said that you've screened in several states.
Yeah, Todd, you want to start with I'll do the awards. You got the screenings, so you can pull that up. Again, when I made this, April, I never thought I'd be talking to you and we'd be going out to your beautiful part of the country to show the film in a place where Pat's art is and where she and Jerry spent 20 years. I never dreamed of this. I was doing interviews and I was putting it aside. So to all of a sudden, the film festivals that we entered are real film festivals. We have an executive producer who didn't want us entering little ones, but these are important ones. And Fort Lauderdale Film Festival was the first place to recognize us. And we got an award there, the Spirit of Independence film there. We were at the Madrid Film Festival, Omaha, which is a big one. Coming up next week is the Julian Dubuque, Iowa International Film Festival. And we just got an award for the Spacefaring Film Festival in Australia.
Wow.
I'll let Todd speak to the screenings and stuff, but these were places where no one even knew how to pronounce my name. There was we had no $1 million funding of PR people. These were people that just watched the film. They got, in some of these, they get 1,500, 2,000 films and they pick 30. And these are people that just saw the value in the film. And April, I want to say one other thing before I throw it to Todd, which is really important. I'm looking at the film now like a parent of a 20-year-old. I don't feel like I'm taking credit for it when I speak to it. Todd and I stand in the back of the theater and people respond to it. And at first, you know, I was like, our film, our baby, our baby, our baby. And now it's, I'm seeing the film as if I had nothing to do with it. I really am. And I could speak proudly of how, because I see it that the stories and the music of the film are what the people are responding to. They don't care that I edited it well, and they don't care that Todd mixed it well. They don't. If they noticed all that, they'd be taken out of the experience. Right. So I'll let Todd talk a little bit about the screenings, because this has been very exciting.
Yeah, screenings. Boy, think about this. The first thing that you would do if your friends are going, hey, what have you been doing the last couple of years? Hey, you haven't gone out and played a lot of shows. You know, I'm a performer, right? And I said, well, I've been working on a film. When you work on a film for 2 years and people say, hey, what have you been doing? Well, I've been working on a film. They go, is it the same film? Yeah, it is. So the first thing we really wanted to do, number one, we wanted to show the film to Pat's friends. So we went, the very first time it was shown, it was even before we went to the International Film Festival of Fort Lauderdale. We went to her retirement community where she lives now and had a gala event. The residents were dressed to the nines, tuxedos and gowns, champagne. They really did it up big. And we had the most amazing night. And
these are 300 people. It was big.
And the first thing they said is, when can we see it again? We want to show our friends. You know, they got really excited about it. So Bill actually went back a month or two later and had an encore performance there. Oh. We definitely wanted to show it to our hometown crowds where we teach. So we went to Manchester and had a showing there, and it was a thrilling sold out performance. And all of the, and the beauty was Pat was there, you know, to see friends, you know, that she knew very well. And they got to ask her questions about it. And it was always, Pat, we had no idea of all the things you've done in your life. They're both, she and Jerry were very unassuming. So we got to do that. And Bill got to, a lot of his students came back to just say, wow, this guy really does know a thing or two about making films, which was great. And then we went to one of two of the brand new, how do you describe these?
Well, they're IMAX.
IMAX theaters, but it's the next generation IMAX, right? And there is one in Syracuse, New York. So we had a showing there on the worst night of the, you can relate to this, because it was 20 below zero and snowing and sleeting and the wind was howling. It was just crazy.
Sold out.
Yep. And sold we out. Had a great show. And Bill and I got to answer questions from our friends. We've done a number of encore presentations, not only in Manchester, but another really cool screening thing that we're starting to see are senior citizens groups, extended learning people who are just quest for knowledge, and they live through this stuff. So we've gone to a number of those places. One of the great screenings that's coming up is in Stamford, Connecticut. And this is, they just get it. It's actually a museum and nature center, but they're building an observatory there. And so they're having now this is just outside New York City, Stamford, Connecticut. It's a $500 a plate fundraiser for their new observatory and, you know, space stuff, right? And we're going to screen the film there and speak. You know, we want to answer questions.
Which we're doing in Arkansas also, just so you know, we are traveling out to your beautiful place. I have to just jump in. Are you going to be able to make the event?
I probably will be able to. I need to double check, but yes, I would be the
person. If you can't, and if you feel like a screening of the film would help you with the article, just send me a note and I'll get you a screener's copy. Just don't share it outside of your circle, but it might, you know, the film speaks for itself now. We don't have to pitch it. All we do is, like what Todd was talking about with Stanford, the woman hired us because she'd heard about the film from friends. And then I said, you probably should watch it before you invite us there. And then she called back and said, oh, this is perfect. We're doing our big fundraiser, $500 a ticket, after she saw it. And this is a woman Todd and I have no connection with. We don't know her. So it's not like she's doing this and people are coming to see me and Todd. They're not. They're coming to see the film. I don't know anybody in the town. And that's the kind of response we're getting. You know, I think that it means so much to me and to Todd, and I know to Pat, to be going to Arkansas with the film. This Arkansas premiere is important to us. There's a lot of places we're going and it's exciting, but this one, Pat and Jerry, you know, they lived in Arkansas. They made their art in Arkansas for two decades. They gave a lot of money and time to museums and to education. To go back there for us to bring it out there is important. And I'm just so excited because there's a lot of Arkansas in the film. Once they get together, their art was made in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. So the latter half of the film deals with, in fact, three of the pieces deal with your part of the country, your specific part of the country, like within 20 miles of you. So
that's awesome. And she had, her art was shown at Crystal Bridges and Arkansas.
It's still at Crystal. She has one of her major pieces is called The Place Where They Cried. And I believe it was Alice Walton. I don't think it was Helen. I think it was Alice, but I don't know. So don't quote me. But the family wanted to commemorate the fact that the museum was near where the actual Trail of Tears went. And they're very, the entire family is very understanding of that and the importance of it. And Pat was commissioned to make a piece that's outside. You leave, I can't wait to go back and visit it, but you leave the museum and it's just a short little bike ride. And you have this amazing piece of these stones, which appear to be people that walk down through a river and up the other side. And that was right where the Trail of Tears went. And the stone was from, am I gonna get this right? Devil's Den, Devil's Canyon. What is it called?
Devil's Den.
Yeah. So we went hiking there, my wife and I did, before we left. And that was where Pat, she always wants the pieces, the wood, the steel, the rock, the trees, to be from the place where the art is going to be or representing that. And that was critical for her. So it isn't just a piece that they set up. They worked on it for quite a long time. They went out there a number of times and walked the Devil's Den to find out where they could quarry the rock for the museum. Pretty cool stuff.
I didn't realize that about her sourcing.
Yes, her sourcing. Everything that she sourced was from the area where the art was going to be, or from the area where the art was going to be about.
Yeah, that's really cool. We left off Todd with the Stanford.
Oh, with the Stanford event. Also, we're finding that people who see the film want to show it to their friends or host a screening. That's happened a few times. We did one in a little town called Little Falls, New York. And there's this wonderful company that helped sponsor one of our events. And they said, we got to show the people in our hometown where our office is. So they booked a cinema, you know, the theater, And we had a wonderful night there, and they asked a lot of great, 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 great questions. We had receptions, and it was like they turned it into, I don't want to say it was a company promotion, because it wasn't. It was more like a gift to their community.
And it was the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the waitresses, the teachers. I mean, it really, the construction workers, they were all there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we love those kind of screenings. And now we're seeing that there's a pretty good chance that, and it makes a lot of sense. Our manager is kind of looking at, you know, some residential place, you know, older folks who really would enjoy the film, and taking it around. It's kind of hand-to-hand combat, isn't it? It's like being, you know, I can relate it to my business, you know, a little rock and roll band, because when I was, you know, around rock and roll at the beginning, and so I'd be at a lot of gigs or play with, you know, people who, you know, Bob Seger shows up and plays for 50 cents at a local club, right, before he made it, and The Police, you know, we did sound for The Police on the first American tour. And, you know, there'd be like 75 people in the audience. That's it, right? Until you finally can turn the corner. We're hoping that someday, if enough people, you know, get to see it in their residence facility or in their local cinema, that, you know, it'll gain a little bit wider exposure, and we can not only take it to other general public people, but also film, you know, theaters and streaming, of course. And then eventually, because it is so chock full of documentary style, wonderful history, that we would love students to take it apart and see some of these scenes.
Well, you're in a good location with this one for that, because you're just off the edge of the university campus.
Oh, awesome.
Well, I have exactly 2 minutes left on this call before it kicks us off. Was there any last thing that you wanted to let me know about the film or the screening? And then
most people don't, I would just mention that most people don't get to see a documentary in a theater. So you tend to watch it, get up and leave, and it draws, and I mean, any documentary would be the same as ours, but this draws you in. People don't move during the film. It's pretty incredible watching, you know, it's a chance for people to watch an award-winning screening of a film that you can't see anywhere else with the director and the composer there.
Right.
If you let me know, I'll send you a link to the screener if you want that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay. Just send me a note to remind me. And also, you can go on the website if you need to steal anything else.
Okay, I will. It was a pleasure to speak with both of you. Thank you so much.
Be safe from this weather.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. Thank you.
Great. Take care.
Thanks, April.
Bye.